What shall we do in the face of COVID-19? I was thinking a lot this week about useless information, given what is happening, especially south of the border, when I stumbled upon this story. A newbie balloonist was blown off course and is forced to land rather suddenly. He's in a field close to a roadway and has no idea where he is. He sees a car coming along the road and he waves it down and the man stops. The driver gets out and the balloonist says to him, "Howdy, can you tell me where I am?" "Yes, of course," says the driver. "You've just landed in your balloon and with this wind you've obviously been blown off course. You're in the top field on John Dawson's farm, 10 miles from Charlotte. John will be plowing this field next week and sowing wheat. There's a bull in the field. It is behind you and about to attack you." At that moment, the bull reaches the balloonist and tosses him violently over the fence. Luckily, the balloonist is unhurt. He gets himself up, he dusts himself off, and says to the motorist, "I see that you're an appraiser." "Good grief," says the other man. "You're right. How did you know I was an appraiser?" "Well, I employ appraisers," said the balloonist. "The information you gave me was detailed, precise, and accurate. Most of it was useless, and it arrived too late to be of any help to me." This little story really resonated with me this week in light of the ongoing corona pandemic. I was reading the Toronto Star on August the 4th, about all the conspiracy theories that are floating around about this pandemic. Too many people, it said, are retrieving their information and advice about the pandemic from social media and from sources that are not vetted properly or have no scientific basis. Such is the case with the outrage that some are displaying over having to wear a mask in public areas, or the President of the United States assuring everyone that if you just took a malaria medication, you would be cured of the coronavirus. The conclusion of that particular article is a powerful one. The article goes on to describe that how you respond to the requests of the health officials about wearing a mask or washing your hands or keeping social distance comes down to a fundamental choice. Do I see society as a collection of individuals seeking their own personal fulfillment, no matter the consequences to others? Or do I see society as a mass of humanity, all interconnected and all being affected by everyone else? These effects could be positive or negative depending on the actions that people take. Today's story from Jeremiah is enormously important to me. Yet, I am well aware that in just reading the passage without some context, it's pretty baffling to see how this could be important given our current circumstance. So that's my job, right? Why is it that a man buying a piece of property 2,600 years ago has any significance whatsoever to our life and our faith, much less a story that I would call enormously important to me? I hope I can help you to see why it's important to me. Jeremiah was an Old Testament prophet living in the city of Jerusalem around 600 years before the birth of Jesus. I will confess right off the top that he's my favorite prophet for many reasons. He ministered during a very tumultuous period of history in the kingdom of Judah, which was the southern kingdom of the Jewish people. You know how people get labeled in life? And everyone reacts to them based on that particular label or that perception? Well, Jeremiah came to be known as a prophet of doom and gloom, a constant critic of the king Zedekiah and the nation and its people. How bad was it? Well, it's 52 chapters worth of bad. It was so bad that if you look in Webster's dictionary under Jeremiah, it not only defines him as a Hebrew prophet, but also as a person who is pessimistic about the present and foresees a calamitous future. He's also called the weeping prophet. Do you know any Jeremiahs in your life? Hold on, it gets worse. His very name has been co-opted into our language as a word. A gerrymand is defined as a prolonged lamentation or complaint, or as a cautionary or angry tirade. Prolonged lamentation, angry tirade. These are what we associate with Jeremiah the prophet. Doom and gloom and criticism. This is what God called Jeremiah to do. He didn't like it. He makes that pretty clear. He didn't want to spend his life doing this kind of thing, but he did it anyway. He stood in Jerusalem and loudly denounced just about everything to everybody that was going on. And he proclaimed that God was getting ready to bring doom or destruction down on the people of Jerusalem. Maybe some historical context will help us. The northern kingdom of Israel, which we looked at in the last service we had together, fell to the nation of Assyria in the year 721 BC. The southern kingdom of Judah, where Jeremiah lived, was made up of the two remaining tribes of Israel, Benjamin and Judah, and was increasingly isolated and vulnerable to the surrounding powers in the Middle East. Judah had paid Assyria not to invade them, as they had Israel, and had formed an alliance with Egypt, which they hoped would protect them. Jeremiah was called by God to be a prophet about 100 years after the fall of the northern kingdom. There was a new developing threat in the world at that time. It was called the nation of Babylon. And Jeremiah prophesied in the capital city of Jerusalem right up until the defeat of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586 BC. It was also the period of exile, as the Judeans were taken away to Babylon. Jeremiah told the people that God couldn't understand why they hadn't learned any lessons from the experience of the northern king of Israel, or kingdom of Israel. They continued to do the same old things, trust in the same false gods, oblivious to the fact that without God, their destruction was imminent as well. Jeremiah told the Judeans that God wanted them to trust him and him alone, rather than weapons or alliances with other nations or idols of wood and silver. The temple actually created a special problem for getting the message through to the people of Jerusalem. They viewed the temple as God's home, God's dwelling place, and were firmly convinced that God would let nothing bad ever happen to the temple. One day, Jeremiah goes into the temple and he told everyone, anyone who would come and listen to him, that if they went to the temple and prayed one day a week, and then went out and did terrible things for 6 days of the week, everything would be okay. They were crazy, he said, essentially. Jeremiah criticized the king, and he criticized especially other prophets who were going around saying everything was A-okay. Jeremiah took on priests, he took on other prophets, he took on the people. One day he was so angry about some people participating in human sacrifice that he took a clay pot and said, "This is what God is going to do to you." He smashed the pot to smithereens. You see, Jeremiah was a very visual preacher. He used props all the time to make his points to the people. In 597 BC, the Babylonians came, and they carried off exiles to Babylon. But they had actually spared the city of Jerusalem and left some of the people behind. This reinforced the belief that Jerusalem would never fall, but Jeremiah said that the complete destruction of the city was still coming. Another prophet said that the exiles who were already in Babylon would be brought back and all would be restored in 2 years. Jeremiah wrote a letter to the exiles and told them to build homes, plant vineyards, and have children, and work for the good of Babylon for a long time, because it would be their home for a long time. Jeremiah also had a faithful scribe named Baruch, but it was not recorded that he had any friends in life. He had enemies aplenty, there were death threats, there were imprisonments. None of it seemed to shut him up. There were days, as with anyone, when he felt like he was wasting his time, wasting his energy, his life, and he just wanted to quit, to give up. But he continued to warn his nation of God's displeasure and impending judgment if they did not return to him. Finally, the armies of Babylon returned 10 years later. They surrounded Jerusalem and cut off all their supplies. It was a siege. An army from Egypt approached from the south to assist in the defense of Jerusalem as they had before. Jeremiah counseled the king to surrender to the king of Babylon and to submit himself for exile. The king was angry, so he had Jeremiah imprisoned for treasonous advice and for the negative effect he was having on the people. And so the Babylonians began their siege upon Jerusalem, and Egypt could not stop them. And Jeremiah was imprisoned in the palace courtyard. It was while he was in prison that the Babylonians surrounded the entire city. And Jeremiah's cousin, Hanamel, comes to him with a business proposition in today's passage. He came to ask Jeremiah to buy his land in Anatoth. Anatoth was where Jeremiah was from. It was his hometown. What he is asking Jeremiah to do is actually described in the scriptures in Leviticus 25. It provided that if a family were in danger of losing their land because of financial difficulties, it was up to the eldest male member of the family to purchase it so it would not be lost to the family. It's called, interestingly enough, the right of redemption. Redeeming family land so that it would be kept in the family. What makes this whole story absurd is that Hanamel's land is lying beyond the northeast wall of the city of Jerusalem. And what's going on right now on that land? It was most certainly occupied by the armies of Babylon. They had their tents on it, for goodness sakes. Jeremiah is in prison, the land is occupied, and people are fully realizing the truth of Jeremiah's prophecy that Jerusalem was about to fall into the hands of the Babylonians. The chances of Jeremiah ever being able to use that land were slim to none. The nature of his bombastic prophecies make us cringe as we await the response he's going to give to Hanamel about how this land is basically forfeit and there's no point in buying it. It's just going to end up being thorns and brambles. But to utter astonishment of everyone, Jeremiah agrees to the purchase, saying that the Lord had told him to do this. And he doesn't do it quietly. Jeremiah never did anything quietly. He makes a big production out of it because he wants everyone to know about it. I'm sure this did nothing to make the people change their mind about him as being a little bit of a nut. Scriptures say that Jeremiah measured out 17 shekels of silver. Now, at this particular time in history, a shekel was a measure of weight, not an actual coin. Was he buying low or was he buying high? We have no way of knowing. We don't know the size of this parcel of land, nor do we know the relative value of the money at that time. What we know is that it was a purchase that made no sense from a practical standpoint. And then he makes a big deal out of the preparation and the preservation of the deed, which had to look absolutely absurd to the people who were wandering around in the courtyard or just trying to survive the night. But Jeremiah has the deed prepared along with a copy. He gets witnesses to sign it and generally does everything decently and in order. One copy is sealed and one is open. The open one is for public record. Perhaps the sealed one would have greater validity. We just don't know. Then Jeremiah entrusts the deed to his scribe Baruch with instructions to put them in a clay pot where they can be preserved for a long time, just like the Dead Sea Scrolls were preserved. Why did he do this? Why did he buy this piece of land? Well, here's the punchline. Jeremiah says, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards shall again be bought in this land." You see, the city is about to fall, but judgment will not be the last word. Everything has to be turned upside down here in the city. And for years, Jeremiah had prophesied doom and gloom, trying to break through the numbness of the community, the Pollyanna belief that everything would be okay. Does that sound familiar? Finally, the reality has sunk in and the people are sinking into despair and hopelessness that all is lost. And now it's Jeremiah who changes his focus and says, wait a minute. This is not the end of the story. God is still our God and we still have a future as a people. Because God ensures the future, I am redeeming this piece of property. This is indeed trust for the long haul. This is not an investment in the stock market when it is down, trusting that somehow the stocks will rise in value in a couple of years and will pay a profit. This is an investment which Jeremiah never expects to use personally, but which he expects his family, his people, to use at some future point. It is a future which no one can see at the moment. He has prophesied that there's going to be 70 years in exile. But now he says that one day the people will come home and be restored, and we must not lose hope or faith in that. Jeremiah has not suddenly changed his tune and decided that things are going to get better right at that very moment. Defeat, destruction, exile, separation, they're all going to happen just as he said. There will be a long wilderness experience, a time of reorientation and new learning and new insights. And in time, there will come a new beginning, a new creation. Ezekiel would see a vision during the exile in which God would bring together the dry, dusty bones of Israel. He would reconnect them. He would put flesh on them and breathe life into them and give them a new future. Now you began to wonder, why is this story important to me? Perhaps you found something that was important to you. Lately, in my mind, it seems that we're all facing the armies of Babylon, who have figuratively hemmed us in. And it feels at times like that the Babylonians are ready to come in and finish us off. Maybe we've been denying that it was going to happen, like refusing to wear a mask, or refusing to social distance, or maybe we're struggling against anything bad happening. But we finally come up against the stark realization that indeed, it's happening. The virus means that some people are going to lose their jobs. The virus means that some significant relationships are going to break down. The virus is everywhere, and it seems like we're powerless to stop it. The end of something is at hand, we fear. And in place of denials and struggles and excuses of false hope, there is the beginning of grief and a temptation to despair. The temptation is so great to want to hold out some kind of false hope for people sitting in that difficult place, to want to fix it, to want to assure them that everything's going to be okay, but there's no integrity in that. It encourages wishful thinking rather than hope. The truth is that endings happen, and often they can be enormously painful. Things are not the same afterwards. We're called to trust for the long haul. You have to build a home and plant a garden in a place perhaps you don't want to be in life. You have to let other people or forces control your life for a period of time until you learn difficult lessons. But you have to have a hope that God's still with you, that God still loves you, He still cares for you, and will still be at work in your life and has a future for you. If I didn't have faith in such a God, I'm sure I would have changed jobs many times ago, many years ago. If I didn't have faith in God like that, I wouldn't have got through this health crisis of mine. Stories from the Bible also resonate, like Jeremiah's, and they help us to navigate these difficult days. There's stories like Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers, but later on tells him that God meant all of this for good so that many could be saved from a famine.
Stories like Naomi being blessed by her Moabite daughter-in-law Ruth after the death of her husband and two sons. Stories like Hannah and Samuel and Eli and David and Jonathan, Jesus and John the Baptist and Mary Magdalene, as well as Mary the mother of Jesus. These stories help me understand how hope does not disappoint us. But watching the people I sit with move over time from despair to hope, from exile to home, from bitterness to joy, that is what keeps me going. And that's what helps me know what is possible. An intriguing part of today's story that I have not told you yet is that Jeremiah told this story to King Zedekiah. As the Babylonian army moved closer onto the city, Zedekiah went to visit his old tormentor in his prison cell. I guess as the Babylonian king would years later, the king of Israel or king of Judah finally saw the writing on the wall. He just wanted to know one thing. He wanted to know why. Why was your message always against me and so negative? My guess is that as with many crises, questions, the true question was, where is God in all of this? Jeremiah does not answer his question. Instead, he tells him the story. It reveals a different side of Jeremiah that the king has never seen before. You see, Jeremiah is not being unpatriotic. He does not get pleasure out of being negative or opposing the king. He is being obedient to his call. And in the case of this story, he is called to do something outlandishly hopeful in the name of God. He redeems the field of his cousin Hanamel in anticipation of God's redeeming grace on his people in the future to come, when God will restore them to their home so that they will not be lost forever as a people. We know in the scriptures that suffering produces endurance. Endurance produces character. And character produces hope. And we know hope does not disappoint us.